The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and our guest this week is Richard Turin. You know, one of the most important things that you can plan for in process of your retirement is what you're going to do with your leisure time and recreation. It's as important as administering your business affairs and anything else you do. And we will discuss today riverboat cruises. Seems to be a growing activity on the part of people who are retired. What are they like? What are the good ones? What are the bad ones? But all of that aside, periodically, you know, we've discussed studies here on the program that have been done on the area of retirement. Some people are calling retirement the new crisis in America, such as Nobel laureate Merton, whom we recently interviewed on the show. And ironically, that crisis hits women especially hard. There was a new report produced by the National Institute on Retirement Security that points to an alarming trend that shows that 80% of women are more likely than men to be impoverished than men at age 65. And women are three times more likely than men to be living in poverty as they pass over into their 70s. So if you are a husband listening to this program, you need to go get your wife and have her listen to it as well. If you're a woman, divorced or single, this show is about you. We're going to discuss this new study, why women are more likely to end up in poverty during their retirement years, and what can be done to avoid poverty. But first, Jim, let's discuss the findings of the new study so we have some kind of a framework for this conversation.
You know, it's amazing, John. Have you noticed? I think this reflects more the fact that the statistic that we have about 10,000 boomers moving into retirement almost on a daily basis, and it's going to be like that for the next decade. So it's not surprising that we've seen a number of different studies that have come out over the last year, everything from how much it's going to cost you to retire, when you can retire, what do you need to retire, as well as looking at various ethnic groups in retirement and also gender. And so if you take a look at these, all of them been done on retirement because this is one of the biggest segments or the largest retirement population in the history of this country. But this particular study that was released this week was focused exclusively on women. Now, what we know from the Department of Social Security is that women make up about 85% of surviving spouses receiving Social Security benefits. So Social Security is a very important component for women who are retiring. Now, unfortunately, last year, led by the president, Congress passed a bill that made the plight of women worse off by removing a lot of the benefits that were put into effect in 2000 to enhance or correct many of these disparities between women and men, and especially women heading into retirement. And that's what this new study highlights, many of the reasons why women are more likely to end up in poverty as they live out their retirement years. And they looked at it from income sources, longevity, all kinds of different ways, pensions, sources of income. You know, in other words, why were these statistics showing up? Why were women more likely than men to end up impoverished in their retirement years? And that's what this study was all about.
Well, that's a good question because I guess, you know, as you just mentioned, is it income equality or they're living longer? They tend to live longer than men. That's not fair. But anyway, they spend part of their lives, though, giving birth and raising children. Does that have a contributing factor, their lower income production, if they do choose to raise kids and forego part of a career to do that? Or maybe it's all of the above.
It was a number of factors. I mean, the study focused on four different aspects of retirement. Number one, women need to work longer than ever before. We'll get into one of the reasons why, which we've talked on this program a number of times when it comes to Social Security. On average, women will take 13 years out of their working career to raise and give birth to children. And Social Security is based on your average income over 35 years. So in order to correct that, these number of years that you've been out of work. Women need to put more work years in. In other words, they're going to need to retire later to improve those statistics. So that was one of them. Secondly, surprisingly, women have greater access to retirement plans with participation levels pretty equal to what men have, but women aren't taking full advantage of them for a number of reasons. They may not be working full time, or, for example, they may be single parents, and it's just harder to put aside that money for savings. Third, they took a look at what happens to women as they age. It gets actually worse when they get in their 70s, and they're more likely to run into financial difficulties because, number one, as we get older, and especially women being living longer, they're going to run into issues like long-term care and more health issues, so they'll end up spending more money on health care. And four, now here's the surprising thing, they're more likely to have a pension plan, whether it's a defined benefit pension plan or a defined contribution plan for the different sectors or industries they tend to gravitate towards. But a lot of women don't take advantage of it for various reasons. It may be work hours, or it might be you just don't have the money to put the money in the plan. So they looked at this from various aspects, and the findings were somewhat surprising. And they're looking to the government in Social Security because Social Security tends to be a greater factor in income for women in retirement. And the government just reduced those benefits with the passage of those sweeping changes to Social Security that we've talked here on the program going back to last November.
Well, you know, on the surface, it would seem that a lot of these would be reasons a woman would be better off during retirement and not impoverished.
Well, I mean, on the surface, yes, John, but like anything else, the devil is in the details. For example, women may be working in industries that have pension plans or are more likely to have pension plans, but they may be part-time workers, so they may not be eligible, or they may be a single parent or head of household raising kids by themselves and just cannot spare the extra money to put into something like a defined contribution plan, like a 401k plan.
Okay, well, if the devil is in the detail, let's go ahead and delve into this, see if we can shed some light as to why there's a greater probability of a woman winding up impoverished during retirement.
Yeah, the first part of the study focused on women working. And surprisingly, women have always worked, but the participation rates of women in the workforce have never been greater than they are today. And it started out, John, with the 70s, with because of inflation, higher taxation, the wife had to go to work and become a member of the workforce to make ends meet. So it started in the 70s, but the participation of women in the workforce has gone from 42% in 1976 all the way up to almost 74% today. Now, depending on the age group that you're in, it is 74% participation rate for women between the ages of 25 and 54. It is about 60% for women between the ages of 55 and 64, less women working in that age bracket. And then it's more encompassing. It's 70% if you take a look at women between ages 25 and 64. What the study found is, unlike mothers or grandmothers, women now work well into their retirement years, and the study found some may not even retire at all. So according to this study, most women will need to delay their retirement in order to avoid poverty or becoming impoverished.
We know one time one person in a household could bring in everything that was required for the whole household. And of course, that isn't the case anymore. So that's why women need to work, because it takes two to make it through today, given what we've done to our currency, etc. I can only imagine it would be much harder for single women, especially harder for single women with children.
You know, it really is. The study pointed out the number of reasons for this trend of women working longer. There were a number of them. Number one, making up for the reduced work hours and earnings earlier on in their career when they took time out to have children and raise children. And, you know, as I pointed out, according to the Department of Social Security, out of that 35-year work period that they base your Social Security earnings on, 13 for women were zero because they were not working. And so they had a zero averaged into their average work pay. And of course, that leads to a lower Social Security retirement. A second reason is offsetting losses from the Great Recession. Everybody knows that, you know, if you take a look at the last decade, we began the new century with a bear market that saw the bursting of the tech bubble. Stocks were down 45%. It happened again between 2007 and 2009. So a lot of people getting close to retirement, and especially women, didn't have the assets that they thought they were going to have, just as men likewise didn't, because of the result of two bear markets. But the main reason is that when you look at the three-legged stool that we have for retirement, that's always been pensions, Social Security, and savings. For women, it's not just less Social Security earnings, it's also a shortfall in savings is also a major factor here.
Let's look at the idea of pensions, because most companies today offer some sort of retirement plans, typically a 401k or something like that. And if women work in government, they're likely to have a defined benefit plan. But are there ways they're missing out on that?
I mean, this was probably maybe one of the good news stories coming out of this study. It showed women consistently surpassed men in the likelihood that their employers offered some form of a retirement plan to their workers. And this has a lot to do, John, with the sectors of the economy that you'll find most women choose to work in. Specifically, women are more likely to be employed in, for example, in education, healthcare industries, and also as well as public and nonprofit sectors. Now, these are sectors of the economy that have a higher proportion of workers with access to retirement plans, especially if you're working in the public sector, like, for example, education, or working for state or local, or let's say the federal government. Because of the sectors of the economy chosen to work in, according to the study, 63% of women worked in jobs where their employers offered either a defined benefit, which would be the best kind of pension plan to have, or a defined contribution plan like a 401k plan. But the bad news is only 46% of women actually participated in a plan. And there were a number of reasons for that. Either one, they were not eligible because of work hours, or they chose not to participate because they needed the income. They simply, like, for example, in a 401k plan, if you're a working mother, head of household, taking care of the family, you may not have that extra money to put into a 401k plan, so you're not participating. Or because, and especially we saw this after the passage of Obamacare, where a lot of employers basically started to cut back on work hours to circumvent the stringent and expensive requirements under Obamacare. So there are a number of things that happen, and that's one of the reasons, even though they're working in sectors that do have pension plans, many of them are not either eligible or participating.
And other factors that contribute to the impoverishment in retirement, besides the lack of pensions, due to work hours or they're unable to afford contributions?
I mean, the other factor is related to the investment preferences and risk tolerances. You know, if you take a look, according to the study, women are generally more conservative when it comes to investing, and they're less comfortable, let's say, with risky investments versus men. And they cited a study done by Fidelity and Vanguard. Fidelity found women hold, for example, more balanced portfolios than men. They have a higher asset allocation in blended assets. That means kind of like stocks, bonds, and cash. They tend to invest more age appropriately. In other words, as they get older, they get more conservative versus men. So they tend to have, John, believe it or not, better rates of return, reflecting the fact that women generally do much better in a bear market because they're more conservatively investing. However, according to Vanguard, they tend to save less, which is the other side of the problem. They may have better returns, but they're putting less money away. The problem is they tend to live longer than men. So according to Vanguard, they're going to need to stretch out their smaller savings over a longer period of time. So when they do begin to draw down savings, that rate needs to be at a much, much smaller rate than men because, you know, according to statistics, and it's proven by Social Security, they live longer.
Now, if we take your three-legged stool, which consists of retirement, income, pension, Social Security, and savings, how do women stack up against men when you look at all three major sources of income?
Well, once again, this gets to one of the major issues at stake here in terms of increasing poverty is longer life expectancies, let's say, with the woman. The woman's lifespan tends to be 4 to 6 years longer than men, and sometimes we see that is actually even longer than that. Women also have a greater risk of exhausting their retirement savings. I mentioned, you know, the Fidelity study and the Vanguard study, which shows that they're putting less money away. And this is also due, John, due to lower Social Security benefits and less income from retirement accounts than men. And here's the issue. Even though they live longer, they have less income, less Social Security benefits, they face similar expenses. I don't care if you're looking at housing, food, transportation. But here's the one big issue that comes up. However, because of that longevity, they are more likely to need more expensive long-term care provided, let's say, by a facility or a paid caregiver. And there was a study that was done by Wider Opportunities for Women, and they came up with something called the Elder Index, which is sort of an economic security index, and it took a look at couples versus single individuals, and they tried to come up with an index for housing, food, transportation, healthcare, miscellaneous expenses, and whether you had a mortgage or didn't have a mortgage, you were a renter. And it was amazing, the figure that they came up. Now, if you were an elder person and you didn't have a mortgage, the index showed that you spend about $20,000 a year. Now, remember, these are just average indexes. If you're a renter, it was $24,000. If you had a mortgage, it was $30,000. If you were a couple, the figure goes from $31,000, $35,000 to $41,000. So you can see that, you know, basically these expenses go up, and what you really want to do now, these are just basic expenses. This doesn't include cruises, going on vacation, or extraordinary medical expenses. The problem in this study is the composition of income. In the Fidelity study, they cited, for example, payments from Social Security are the largest source of income for the majority of older Americans, and especially if they no longer work. The Social Security benefits account for 90% or more of income received by nearly half of unmarried women, including widows age 65 and older. According to the study, in 2014, the average Social Security income received by a woman 65 years and older was only $13,824 compared to the average benefit of men, which was almost $18,000. So once again, this study said that women, because of lower Social Security benefits, lower pension benefits, need to save a lot more because Social Security is the largest source of income for women. And you'll see when we get to solutions, one of the reasons why you're seeing women work longer today, they're trying to make up for those average 13 years in which they were out of the workforce. So since the Social Security benefit is based on the average of 35 years, it's the last 35 years. So let's say a woman was out of the workforce for, let's say, 5 or 6 years. Well, if she works another 5 or 6 years, she can negate those years where she was adding zeros in that average, which is one reason not only do women need to work longer, they need to supplement and increase their savings because they do live much longer. The reduction in benefits that we saw from Social Security and defined benefit plans, this is another thing that hits women, you know, especially married women, widows. You know, when their husband dies, let's say a husband and wife are married, the wife is getting a Social Security benefit. It could be half of her husband's. Husband is getting a benefit. A husband may have worked for, let's say, the government or a company where he had a pension plan. Some of those pension plans are reduced. They provide a reduced benefit to a surviving spouse. And then the surviving spouse, in this case, the wife, loses her Social Security benefit and will probably end up taking her husband's. So a lot of this happens at the death of the husband, which explains the growing rates of poverty among women as they age. So there are dramatic changes to the financial well-being of women, John. On the death of a husband, she loses, as we mentioned, a source of Social Security income, and there may be a reduction in pension benefits as well. And then she lives longer and is faced with higher medical expenses, which is one reason why the poverty rates tend to be much higher for women.
Well, there it is. There are the disadvantages, but rather ending on a sour note, this is everything that women face as far as preparing for retirement. What can you do to rectify all of these shortcomings so we don't just sit here and go, woe is us?
Well, I mean, the husband tends to be the main breadwinner, or let's say the individual that has the higher income. So naturally, his Social Security is going to be much higher. You know, women take more time off to have babies and raise children, so their benefits are lower. One thing a husband can do to better prepare his wife, if he can, prolong his Social Security benefits. Now, we used to talk about file and suspend, where he would file for a benefit, suspend, and then his Social Security benefits would grow by 8% a year. Now, a husband can still do that if, for example, let's say he was to work part-time for 4 years from, let's say, age 66 to age 70, he could still allow his Social Security benefits to grow at 8% a year. So at age 70, his benefits are going to be 32% higher than they would at age 66, which means that when he passes on, his wife would have access to his Social Security, which would be much, much higher than if he took it out at age 66. So there's one strategy.
Okay, now what about work?
That's another one you can correct. And this is one of the key findings that came out of the study when they were talking to women why they were working longer and, for example, why they were delaying retirement. Because of the number of years they spent outside the workforce, raising children, giving birth to children, if they work longer, not only do they delay their Social Security benefit, which itself tends to grow at 8% a year to age 70, they also can get more credits on their Social Security and make up for those years that they took off to raise children. So that's another one. Another strategy that we've seen come out of this study is that women tend to choose industries that offer greater pension benefits to their workers. So, for example, go into teaching, you get a defined benefit pension plan. You work for the state or the federal government, you can get a defined benefit pension plan. Working in the health industry, you tend to get a pension plan. So working for industries that have a greater probability of having some kind of pension benefit is something that women can choose to do to, let's say, beef up that three-legged stool for retirement. The other thing is, you know, quite simply, and this applies to men as well, is save more, live as simple as you can. I know that sounds easier said than done, but you know what? If you can't count on, let's say, a defined benefit pension plan or Social Security benefits that just got diminished for women, well, you know, one of the things you're going to have to do is that third leg of the stool is increase your savings. And I think, John, that something that should be done between a husband and wife is to really coordinate the retirement plan, looking at medical and pension options, Social Security options to maximize, assuming in most cases where men married a younger woman, or the chance or fact that longevity-wise, women outlive men, is coordinate your retirement plan to make up so that if the husband passes away first, his wife isn't devastated by, you know, let's say loss of her own Social Security benefits or a diminished pension to a survivor, because that was another reason why a lot of widows ended up into poverty because of the very reason of their husband's death.
Yeah, when you think about all of the discussion of women's rights that goes on during election seasons like we're having right now, it's sort of an irony that Congress and the administration have just socked it to women.
Yeah, and it was funny because at the end of the study, they said one of the ways that you can correct this issue is to beef up Social Security for women. Well, they just diminished it for women. So it'll be interesting to see if this comes up in the election. I doubt it. You know, the president proposed it, but both parties signed off on it. And it was done mainly to correct. The president thought that rich people were using these strategies when it was mainly middle class and women that had benefited. And then secondly, there was a shortage in the disability fund. It was going to run out of money at the end of 2016, so this was just a quick fix. They thought they'd just sweep it underneath the carpet and nobody would notice.
A lot of the times, things like we're discussing today, Jim, just require time to emerge into what you would call the media consciousness. And I think that as more and more women head into retirement over the next 10 years, this issue will rise more and more to the surface. I think that's the important thing to recognize. It just takes time. Changing political outlooks and the provisions of government are always like turning a large ship. It's a very slow process. You know, it can be done, but you have to work at it. So coming up very shortly, we're going to have Richard Turin on as a guest. Riverboat cruises for people who are retired, the advantages and things to be aware of. But first, we're going to our case study, which will illustrate the items under discussion here today. And as always, with our case studies, they are real life studies, a real event, but we change the names to protect the people and their privacy.
This week's case study is David in Sharon, Nelson. David was age 64. He was an aeronautical engineer at a major defense contractor here in San Diego. Sharon, age 56, an elementary grade teacher. The plan when they came to see us was David wanted to retire at age 66, and Sharon would need to work to age 62, at which time she would have 30 years into the school system in which she would be eligible for a nice defined benefit pension plan. Now, if we look at their assets, they looked in pretty good shape. They had a home that was worth about $650,000, no mortgage. It was free and clear. Dave's 401k pension plan was worth about $1.3 million. Company stock. He had about 2,600 shares of the company stock that was worth a little over $500,000. Cash, money market funds, and CDs, roughly about $115,000. And Sharon's 403b plan was about $270,000. So pretty good shape financially. A little over $2.8 million, almost $2.9 million in total assets. And more importantly, everything was paid for from the home to the RV.
Well, I guess on the surface of this whole thing, it looks like everything is pretty stable. Sharon has a pension. Dave would seem to have a pension. I'm trying to find a hole in this. What was the problem?
A couple things. Investing, Dave was fully invested in the stock market. And of course, going through 2008 and 2009, where 40% of the assets fell, you know, you don't want to be in that position, which is really concerning Sharon, who is really very, very conservative. In fact, if you look at her 403b plan, you know, a lot of teachers use variable annuities where you have mutual funds, you can put it in stocks and bonds. Sharon was basically in a fixed annuity. She didn't want any fluctuation, any market risk, especially having gone through bear markets and the bursting of the tech bubble. And especially one of the reasons that Dave is working longer is his pension plan and 401k plan took a major hit during the market downturn in 2008 and 2009 because he was 100% invested in stocks. And of course, the market was down 45%. And so that's one of the reasons why Dave is working to age 66, besides being eligible for full Social Security benefits. So that was a big concern for Sharon. She thought that the investments needed to be more conservatively invested. I mean, the company stock, that would be one issue, but all of Dave's pension plan was in stocks, which is one of the reasons, you know, originally he was thinking of retiring at age 62. Obviously, what happened in 2008 and 2009 put a crimp in that plan, which is one of the reasons he has worked as long as he did. The other issue here, and it's particularly acute with Sharon, is longevity runs on Sharon's side. Sharon's mother was 87. Her father passed away at 93. So longevity runs on Sharon's side of the family more so than Dave's. And the other thing that was going to happen for both of them, they were both going to have to work longer than they anticipated. Originally, you know, Dave thought he was going to retire at age 62. That was before the Great Recession. And then, of course, Sharon has to work longer because at 30 years, she'll get 2/3 of her salary of $80,000 as a pension. So a couple of things that we looked at in the plan, Dave's Social Security at age 66, when he would be eligible for full retirement benefits, would be roughly about $2,450 a month. If he was to wait age 70, and you're going to hear why we want to do that, his benefits would grow to $3,340 a month. So a big increase. Sharon, if she works an additional 6 years until age 62, she would have 30 years with the school system, she would get 66 or 2/3 of her $80,000 salary as a pension. That would be $64,000 a year. Now, here was their living expenses, obviously with no mortgage. Their living expenses were about $75,000, a good portion of that being taxes in Social Security. Travel with RV and trips, roughly about $20,000 a year. Total expenses, about $95,000 a year. Now, one of the things that we explained, you know, Dave did need to work two more years if he wanted full Social Security benefits, but that's not what we were going to recommend. And Sharon needed to work six more years, so she would have 30 years with the school system. And Sharon's fortunate enough because the school system has a defined benefit pension plan where she would get close to 66% of her salary.
Okay, well, having put all this together, what was the outcome? And that would include recommendations.
The original plan that Dave had, especially after the Great Recession and the loss of assets, was to continue working two more years to age 66. However, do not take Social Security benefits at age 66. In other words, he wouldn't need to because, number one, Sharon would still need to work six more years in which she'd be getting $80,000 a year plus any increases or COLAs that she would get along the way. So they could pretty much live off actually the dividends from the company's stock in Sharon's salary. So that would do a number of things. It would increase Social Security benefits to Dave, and especially, you know, waiting to age 70, where there would be a 32% increase, which obviously, with Sharon more likely to be the survivor, greater benefits to Sharon. And then also, the thing that one of the big concerns that Sharon had is, and Dave was more willing to go along to be more conservatively invested, because one of the reasons he didn't retire at age 62 is because of what happened during the Great Recession and the loss of assets. So we recommended that he convert his pension into 60% cash in short-term bonds, and especially as we told him that, you know, we expect that we're heading into a bear market and into a recession next year. And, you know, you worked longer because of what happened to you in the Great Recession. What you don't want to do is finally get to age 66, you think you're going to retire, and we have a recession and a new bear market again. You know, you're not going to work to age 70. So ahead of rolling his pension over into an IRA rollover, we recommended the short-term bond funds, which he had access to, and cash of 60%, because all of Sharon's 403b plan was in a fixed income annuity. And so there was no risk there of any market fluctuations. That made Sharon feel more secure and also gave Dave a greater assurance, because basically I just showed him, I go, Dave, you saw what happened in 2000, 2001, when we went through a stock market bubble and a recession, but you also saw what happened in 2008. It was one of the reasons you delayed your retirement. Do you want to go through that all over again? And so that was a couple of changes. So basically, we're getting them ready for retirement. But the one thing that we told them, look, there's no reason you need to take your Social Security at age 66. Sharon's going to be working because she needs that for her pension. So you'll have Sharon's income, the dividends from your company stock, and you still have your IRA. You won't even need that. So part of the plan was not only to have Sharon work to age 62, that would give her her pension, Dave to defer his Social Security to age 70, and also to roll over his pension when he retired, but to defer taking anything until age 70 and a half, which we'd have mandatory distributions. And that way, you know, there's no issues, financial issues, and they had almost a 98% probability of success as we ran stress tests on their portfolio. So, John, basically, in this case, delaying retirement and delaying pension benefits were the solution to this case.
And coming up next, our guest, Richard Turin. We're going to be discussing riverboat cruises, not just the old-fashioned riverboat. We're talking about the modern style as Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, cruising has become a popular form of travel. It's kind of nice being aboard a ship, not having to change hotels on a daily basis, and everything is provided for you, from sleep accommodations to entertainment and food. But there's another form of cruising, and it's called river cruises. Joining me on the program is Richard Turin, who's been rated by Condé Nast as the world's top river cruise specialist. And Richard, let's talk about river cruising. Occasionally, I see the ads on television when I'm watching the evening news. How popular have they become, and how long have they been around?
Well, river cruising, Jim, and I want to say hello to you and your loyal audience. River cruising has been around for about, I'd say 2 decades. I think what has really pushed this segment of the industry, and it is literally the fastest growing segment of the entire industry. Every study has shown that. One company, Viking River Cruises, which currently has 64 river vessels and operates in various parts of the world, and by the way, is coming to put 2 of their ships on the Mississippi, they alone are controlling just about 51-52% of total riverboat inventory. So when you refer to the ads, particularly ads that have been seen on the PBS stations across the country, they're likely Viking River ads, and they have been entirely successful. They've kind of, I think, elevated the entire industry because in terms of what they're showing, absolutely beautiful scenery, and it looks very leisurely, and much in the ads is true. Some of it is exaggerated, and some of the realities are left out.
And how would you compare, let's say, the accommodations on board a river cruise boat versus, let's say, the big ships that we see that are typical out there, like Carnival and other lines like it?
I think Carnival is typical of a mass market cruise line. There are several levels of cruises, and we have a site called Luxury Cruise Ratings where the consumer can actually go and see literally which are the top 10 rated lines. And it's very interesting because Carnival A is not one of them, nor is Royal Caribbean, nor is Norwegian Cruise Line, nor is Celebrity. The big names that people think they know about cruising are not the best rated ships. Actually, the top rated cruise line right now in terms of ocean cruising is Hapag-Lloyd. In terms of cabin size, let me give you a very specific example. If you go on a typical riverboat and you don't want the largest cabin, Jim, you want something kind of mid-range, maybe no balcony, but a nice picture window, the kind of cabin that I think at least 50% of river cruisers would take, those cabins range in size. There are some that are 130 square feet, but most are in the 150 square foot range. Now, I always like to point out that's about the size of a mandated prison cell in some states. It certainly isn't a lot of room, no room for dancing, having a party. If I put you in the worst category, the lowest category, let's say on Regent Seven Seas cruises, the worst that they have is 300 square feet with a beautiful private balcony and a stocked refrigerator. So that'll give you a little bit of an idea. When compared to the mass market cruise lines, they do have smallish cabins, but riverboat cruises, they are limited to a certain size. They have to handle both high and low waters. And I think a lot of us have read about that, and maybe river cruisers have some concerns about that. But these boats have to fit under these bridges, and they are mandated in terms of how large they can be. They have to have a certain draft, etc. So what we find with riverboats is that we don't have the major differences in cabin size among the various lines. They all have some suites that will be in the 300 square foot range. Crystal is launching 4 new riverboats in the next 3 years, and they will have a little bit larger suites than the norm. Scenic has some larger suites, but typically the very best cabin on a riverboat is about the same size as the very worst cabin on an ocean cruise line.
You know, it's rather interesting, and let's talk about their popularity, because I had a client who recently, about a month ago, got on one of those cruise ships that got caught up in that storm and was a very harrowing experience. I would imagine, Richard, if you're taking a riverboat experience, you're not going to get into the rough seas that can happen on an ocean cruiser.
Well, you know, as usual, Jim, you've raised an issue that I could talk to you about for 4 or 5 hours. But let me give you a short take on that. A, you're absolutely correct. River cruises, turbulent water is a non-issue. It's never going to happen. And you always have the ability, every riverboat has this upper deck, you walk up, usually one or most two flights of stairs, and there you are, going through the French countryside, passing castles on the Rhine, wonderful small towns along the Danube, and there are some wonderful, by the way, the best riverboats aren't in Europe. The quality of riverboats in Asia is much higher than it is in Europe even, because they're almost all new boats and they have adequate crew to really provide wonderful services. But your assumption is correct. I just would go back very quickly to the Anthem of the Seas, which hit the rough storms. In my view, no travel agent should have ever taken anyone's money for doing a cruise in the Atlantic Ocean in November. That's the first thing. I mean, it's called the hurricane season, and we should all be aware of it. And going down the East Coast is asking for trouble. The other thing I would point out is that we write for and read the industry magazines, and we have to get at the truth on these things, not necessarily the way it's portrayed on some of the 24/7 news channels. And your audience won't be shocked to know that everything they report about cruising isn't always accurate on those news channels. For instance, the captain of the ship that you referred to was given an award by the Coast Guard and special recognition for the beautiful way he and the crew handled that storm. That was not reported.
No, just the harrowing experience. Of course, you know, that's what makes news, Richard. As we know, if it bleeds, it leads. So
right.
There's something that's scary. They're going to talk about it. But, you know, overall, as you point out in one of your blogs, that river cruises can deliver that five-star experience that you would get on a bigger ocean liner. You say it's one of the fastest-growing segments, so apparently news about the river cruises are getting out there. But shouldn't they be a lot more popular than they are? As you mentioned, they've been around for 2 decades.
This is our second conversation, Jim, but I'm going to disagree with you on that. In fact, most of the top-level cruise lines still have availability in Europe this summer. The riverboats, the better ones, are by and large sold out. I'll give you a very specific example. Tauk Tours operates riverboats that are very highly rated and are inclusive. They've been sold out on virtually every itinerary for several months. And as a matter of fact, we're starting to see, for instance, that particular river cruise line has a Category 7 cabin, which is their upper deck and their 300 square feet. They're very much in demand. Because riverboats sell, unlike cruise ships, riverboats sell from the top down. The most expensive always sells out first. So I can tell you that there are prime dates in 2017 where those Category 7s are not available. People do book early. There has just not been enough inventory on these riverboat lines. And don't forget, they're not just selling to Americans. They can market throughout Europe. There's a very, very popular river cruise line called Scenic, which is an Australian company. So they draw from Europe, from the States, and from Australia, New Zealand. So it is actually, there has not been enough inventory. Now, that's going to start to ease off a little bit. And one of the things that's happening in river cruising is that the building of the ships has proceeded at an unprecedented pace, but we're not seeing the building of berths keeping tab with that building. So here's what happens. We decide we're going to launch a new riverboat, and it's going to take 18 months to 2 years, provided we find a yard that has space to build the boat. And so we can deliver it, planned and ready to sail with itineraries, in about 2 years. you couldn't begin to get a berth built in any of these European ports, given the politics and the policies. It would take at least 4 or 5 years. So berth space hasn't kept up. And so what happens is on some of the itineraries, and this is what those ads that you referred to don't mention, Jim, is that, yes, you have this beautiful day of sailing, and then you go to tie up and go ashore, and you find out there's one berth that three boats have to share, so that you are crossing over maybe one or two other boats, walking across their decks just to get ashore. Now, they don't put that in their ads, but it happens all the time. In fact, I interviewed one cruise line official who had the gall to tell me that his guests love that because it gives them an opportunity to see other ships, which I think is a bit of an exaggeration.
You mentioned that you certainly don't want to take a cruise in the Atlantic in November. And I know, being a sailor, the cruising season, you're usually in the Bahamas and Florida area during the winter. By spring, you're up to Cabo San Lucas, the Sea of Cortez. By summer, you're up to the Pacific Northwest. Are there definitely cruising cycles or seasons? In other words, when you mention November is the hurricane season, well, if you look at the Atlantic, it also starts in summer. So when do you go cruising?
What's happened is that weather patterns have become less predictable. That's true. But it's also true that the weather has become more extreme. So people who do what I do for a living, we have to pay much more attention to weather and weather patterns than we used to. Now, for river boating, what do we know for a fact? We know for a fact that Europe had its hottest summer on record last year in 2015, since records were kept. And that is likely to be beat, that record, this coming summer. So here are all these people who are booking riverboats or cruises in Europe. They're going in July and August, and I hope their travel consultant is telling them that when you go ashore, the heat is likely in the Mediterranean to be so oppressive that you will be dripping wet before you take a few steps. So I don't think that prime season is prime season in Europe in terms of when you're cruising. So that we like May, we like September, and the 10th of September through the 15th of October for Europe would probably be ideal. I'd like everybody to be home from a European river cruise by the 20th of October. You mentioned Alaska. When you look at Alaska, Alaska is totally different. Because Alaska, you do not want to save $200 by going in the early part of the season, pre-season, because the weather there can really ruin your vacation, and there is storm activity. So Alaska is one itinerary you want to do in absolutely prime time. Asian itineraries, if you want to go away Christmas or the holidays, prime time to do a cruise or a river cruise in Asia would be October, the 1st of October, and then running through March. You don't want to go near Asia after that because temperatures in that part of the world can really get so uncomfortable that they're unhealthy. So it really does vary. Crossing the Atlantic Ocean is not something, you know, the cruise lines promote their crossings. Those are the toughest sailings for them to sell, but for a very good reason, because they have to get their equipment, their ship, from Miami or San Juan or wherever it's based. They have to cross the ocean and have it there in late April, early May to start the Europe season. Then they have to bring it back in October, early November. Well, again, that's not the time to be crossing the Atlantic Ocean. So when you see wonderful pricings on crossings, it's not a surprise because you're going to likely hit some difficult weather. So that's a crossing you want to do midsummer. So it varies from place to place as to what you see in when you go. New England, for instance, you mentioned New England and Canada. Those cruises are ideal when the fall colors are changing. Now, they start in September, but in the last couple of years, we found that the colors really are starting to change first week in October, which is generally a little safer time to go in terms of having that wonderful experience where it can still be warm and the leaves haven't changed in September. So I guess what I'm saying is that every single itinerary requires independent analysis and is different as to the optimum time to go. And travel consultants, theoretically, are telling you about this and are experts at this. Don't believe a word the cruise lines tell you, because their marketing people have the job of selling their bad weather dates. That's what they have to do. So they have to kind of talk them up and make it seem like everything's fine. Someone has to be a voice of reason and tell you, well, they may be saying that and offering that, but it's not the time you ought to be going there.
You know, Richard, you and I have talked about this in a previous program, but, you know, today with the emergence of the internet, a lot of people are doing their own booking. They're going through online venues. And a lot of times they're not getting the information that you and I just talked about. But there's this feeling that, okay, it'll be cheaper if I do it online versus working through a qualified agent or a knowledgeable agent like yourself. Let's talk about the myth of the savings if you're doing it yourself online.
I do a fair number of interviews on the radio, Jim, and I tell you, you're the only one who's ever asked me that question. And it's really the right question. And here's why. Let's imagine that I'm an executive and, you know, you and I are the CEOs of a major cruise line. And what do we know? We know about 60, 70%, in some cases, 80 to 90% of all of our product is sold by retail travel agents, because it's a kind of complex purchase. What about the air? What about insurance? What about if I stay a couple of days early? What about using miles? What will I be doing in port, et cetera, et cetera? So it's something that requires a consultant. Okay, so you go online. Now, the online person provides none of that consulting. Do you think the cruise line would want to pay them the same commission? Do you think the cruise line would want you to book online? Because if you did, who are you going to call? You're going to call the cruise line, which means the cruise line has to hire staff to answer the questions of people they haven't even booked. The other thing is, what about just calling the cruise line and booking directly, which you can do? That's always a possibility. I recommend that with airlines, for instance. The scenario of booking air directly with an airline versus an online site, there are a lot of advantages to that. But no cruise line in their right mind is going to allow anyone on the internet to outprice them, because they want the booking to go through a counselor. Online travel agencies don't tell you certain things. What they don't tell you often is that they're call centers. They may be based in Bangladesh. They may be based somewhere else. You don't know. And what if something goes wrong? And how well do they know you? Every conversation you ever have about leaving the United States of America ought to involve a conversation about security and safety and your personal health. Let's face it, a lot of the people, you know, I'm dealing with some millennials, you know, we have a following in Silicon Valley of young people who do a lot of very interesting travel, but that's not the norm. The norm is someone who is approaching or is in retirement age. And sometimes there are health issues that have to be discussed. Is this too busy a program for you? Is there too much walking? What kind of walking? Is it on cobblestone streets? Is it going uphill? Do we want a cruise where maybe we can arrange something private for you to do it at your own pace, et cetera? All those conversations would never take place online, because they are commissioned salespeople, and their job is to get your money. They're never going to tell you that you don't want to be running around Europe in July. They won't do it. They would never risk losing a sale, because they're not interested in a long-term relationship. They're interested in a quick sale. But the great irony is, of course, they don't get better rates. No supplier in travel would ever do that, because they'd be castigated by the industry, and the major distributors of their product would refuse to sell them.
I guess a final question, if I may, and that is, Richard, if you are new to travel, let's say, you know, you worked and most of your vacations were just local, maybe getting in the car, driving someplace. Now you're heading into retirement. You haven't really done a lot of overseas travel. isn't it important talking to an agent because you're talking about a foreign country? You're talking about safety. For individuals that are retired, there's also issues of health when traveling overseas. You know, what happens if you get sick or get a heart attack or something? Explain to our listeners why it's very important to talk to a knowledgeable agent, because all of these issues come into play when you start traveling for the first time. You know, once again, you're going to a foreign country, passport issues, language issues, safety issues, all these things come into play once you start to travel outside the country.
I would draw an analogy between the travel person and the financial planner, and I'll tell you exactly why. First of all, I would urge people to know the difference between an agent and a trusted advisor and consultant. A trusted advisor, you view in the same way you might view your physician or your financial planner. Hopefully you find someone who has your best interests at heart. A travel agent is somebody who wears a headset, is plugged into an airline computer, and is basically selling you pre-packaged programs. It's a whole different profession. About 40 to 45% of all the travel agents have justifiably disappeared. What we have left are some very good agents who do a lot of business travel arrangements, but we now have consultants and advisors who are well-trained, well-educated, who have traveled the world. That's the kind of person you want to go to. Now, a specific answer to your question, when you sit down with a financial advisor and planner, you know, they'll throw a lot of good questions at you. They need to understand your lifestyle, your needs, where you see yourself in the future, and they help design a way for you to get there. That's what a good travel consultant should do. So the person you describe, if they were working with a firm like ours, the first thing we would do is we would get to know them. We have a long profile. We go through their past travels, what their goals are. And then in the scenario you described, Jim, I would suggest a five-year plan. In other words, someone is likely in that discussion to say, I want to do an African safari, or I really want to get to know China. Well, you've got to discuss those and then rank them and say, which one should we put on the back burner and which one offers compelling reasons to do sooner rather than later? And a good consultant will help you do that so that it all becomes very organized and you can kind of focus on which trip ought to come first and which ought to come second.
Richard, if our listeners would like to find out more of the kind of work that you do and the things that you write about, I read your Riverboat blog and I found that rather interesting because I've been seeing these commercials and I'm thinking, boy, that looks very appealing. How could they find out more about the services that you provide?
Well, the easiest way, we have three major websites, and all of them have links to the others. So it's very easy. I won't talk about all of them. I'll just say if you go to Travel Truth, one word, traveltruth.com, that is a good entry-level website because it is only questions and honest answers. We allow no advertising. We take no payment. We don't accept free trips. Our purpose, and quite frankly, we've been very successful at it, we simply tell the truth. Perhaps I'm not smart enough to do fancy marketing, I don't know. But we tell the truth because in travel, that's what's needed. Travel is often based on exaggeration, deception, people's dreams are toyed with. The consumer deserves to know what the real realities are about the travel they're anticipating. So that would be a good place to start. They could contact us off the website. And, you know, any of your listeners who have questions, even if they have no interest in working with us, I'd be happy to help them in any way that I can.
Well, your work has paid off. As I mentioned, Condé Nast has listed you as the world's top river cruise specialist. You've been named by Bespoke Vacation Planners and by other magazines. So keep up the great work. Richard, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you, and I hope we can talk again.
Wonderful, Jim. You travel safe. Take care.
Thank you, Richard.
Interesting when you look at the reality of things versus what's going on at certain government levels. Like I mentioned earlier in the program, government is like a giant ship that takes forever to react and turn. Maybe there's some advantages to that, but a lot of times there are disadvantages. And here in the studies that have come out, women are relying more and more on Social Security than anything else into retirement. And yet we know that right at the end of last year, the great reneging began, in which they're beginning to ratchet back on Social Security benefits, which is because of the fact we're running out of money. And that's the other gorilla in the room. But there is a contradiction here.
Yeah, there is. And it was amazing because a lot of the benefits like file and suspend, file and restrict, which they got rid of last November, were put in place, John, along with full retirement benefits at age 66. They used to penalize you if you worked until age 70 if you tried to get Social Security benefits from 62 to 65. They phased out a certain percentage of your income, like $2 for every $2 you earned over the limit. They would phase out one from age 65 to 70. It was for every $3 you earned over the limit. Well, in 2000, they fixed all that. They said, hey, look, people are living longer. They don't have the assets that they thought they were going to have. So, you know, at age 66, we're boosting that Social Security age by another year and 2 years, depending on when you were born. But when you turn age 66, you can work and get your benefits. The other thing they did is they put in file and suspend, file and restrict to help equalize and make things better for women. Well, they left the age 66 full retirement benefits, but they took away a lot of the benefits that went to surviving spouses as a result of the file and suspend and file and restrict strategies. It'll be interesting to see as we get closer to the presidential election, if any of these issues are brought up. I doubt they will, because they passed this one underneath the rug. Nobody seemed to catch on to it. Nobody has said anything. The media hasn't picked up on it. And most people, quite honestly, John, that get their Social Security benefits aren't even aware of these strategies, because it shows, according to the Department of Social Security, majority of Americans take their benefits as soon as they can get them at age 62. Well, in the meantime, we are out of time as usual here on the Lifetime Income Series. We hope you enjoyed today's show. We're going to be doing some extra special shows in the days ahead. We'll be covering a few more tax issues because we are heading into tax season. Although this year, guess what, folks? They gave you the weekend to stretch out paying your taxes. Tax Judgment Day is April 18th of this year. So we'll be talking more about taxes in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the program. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk. We'll be right back.